Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Jim Bertel reporting. The mayor of Puerto Rico's largest city was criticized by U.S. President Donald Trump Saturday after she pleaded for more federal assistance in the wake of Hurricane Maria. On Friday, San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz said people are dying because of the inefficiency and the bureaucracy. Early Saturday, Mr. Trump hit back on Twitter, accusing the mayor of poor leadership ability and criticizing Puerto Rican officials. The United States has opened a direct channel of communication with North Korea. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who is in Beijing, says the U.S. is investigating whether the regime of Kim Jong-un is interested in pursuing talks to give up its nuclear weapons. He says he is seeking China's cooperation in putting pressure on Pyongyang.
We have preparation for President Trump's important visit, so we want to talk about the agenda for that visit, and then we'll continue our discussions on a number of other issues that are important, but certainly North Korea will be on the table for discussion.
That was Secretary Tillerson during his meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping discussing President Trump's visit in November. Dozens of Afghan forces are said to have been killed in repeated insurgent attacks over the past week in western Farah province, which borders Iran. The fighting in the western Afghan province comes amid allegations Iran and Russia are providing support to the Taliban. Turkey's largest foreign military base in the world opened Saturday in Mogadishu. The ribbon-cutting ceremony included Somali leaders, top Turkish military officials, and diplomats. The head of the Turkish military said the base is the biggest sign of how Turkey wants to help Somalia. From Washington, you're listening to VOA News. Police in Catalonia, Spain, have sealed off more than half of the designated polling stations for the region's banned independence referendum on Sunday. The move came as the Spanish authorities stepped up their attempts to stop Sunday's referendum. Spain's Foreign Affairs Minister, Alfonso Dastis, says this could become a wider issue if Catalans secede.
I mean, it will become a European problem if Catalans broke away. Because that would encourage others in Italy, in France, in Belgium, and in other countries to do the same. So what we are trying to do is trying to prevent that problem from becoming a European one.
Catalan officials say they plan to hold the referendum regardless. A volcano threatening to erupt in the South Pacific has led to the evacuation of an entire island in Vanuatu. A state of emergency has been declared on the island of Ambe, where an increase in volcanic activity has raised fears of a major eruption. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Ash, stones and lava have been thrown from the mouth of the Monaro volcano in Vanuatu, an archipelago in the South Pacific Ocean. Officials have ordered the entire population of 10,000 to leave their homes on the island of Ambe. Many have left for evacuation shelters in coastal areas. The New Zealand Air Force has flown over the area to assess the risk. Group Captain Nick Olney says the situation is volatile.
The crater is erupting. Plumes, lava, smoke, ash. The evacuation of people is quite critical at the moment.
Australia has responded to the emergency by delivering supplies of food, water and shelter. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Two women accused of murdering the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un are expected to plead innocent when their trial begins Monday in Malaysia, according to an attorney representing one of the defendants. The Indonesian and Vietnamese women are accused of murdering Kim Jong-nam on February 13th at Kuala Lumpur International Airport by smearing his face with a deadly nerve agent. After a pretrial court proceeding in July, lawyers of the two women said their clients were led to believe they were taking part in a reality television hoax when they assaulted Kim. The defendants will face the death penalty if they are convicted. The U.S. State Department has announced it is pulling all of its non-essential diplomatic personnel out of Cuba in response to health attacks on 21 American diplomats in Havana. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says the United States is maintaining diplomatic relations with Cuba, but must put the health and safety of American diplomats first. The secretary adds the nature of the attacks remains unexplained. I'm Jim Bertel.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We seriously disagree with what the government has done to the newspaper. Restricting publication of newspapers is contrary to Article 18 of our Constitution.
The Tanzanian government bans yet another newspaper for 90 days.
Him and his boss believe they own his country, they can do anything. I am a bit shocked, but not surprised at all, given his history of statements and actions as well.
The Ugandan Inspector General of Police says he will not apologize for ordering the arrest of parliamentarians.
The commission as itself and with its systems, if those systems are supposed to work as expected, can actually hold that election.
And the Kenyan main opposition party quits negotiations over how to manage next month's presidential election rerun. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Tanzanian government has banned a newspaper for 90 days after accusing the publication of misquoting President John Pemba Magufuli. Information Services Director Hassan Abbas announced the ban. The newspaper had a headline in Swahili which translates, John Magufuli's presidency doomed to fail. The government says the newspaper was previously warned over its publication. 2 weeks ago, another tabloid newspaper was banned for 2 years after the administration accused it of inciting violence. For reaction over the newspaper's ban, I read John Malia, a leading legal team member of the Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema, in the capital, Dodoma.
We have said it clear that we seriously disagree with what the government has done to the newspaper. Restricting publication of newspapers is contrary to Article 18 of our Constitution, provides for people's right to access to information and news, such as news which were publicized by the Raia Mwema newspaper, which has been banned by the government from publishing for the next 90 days. So as a party, we disagree with this trend. We ask the government to reconsider its decision, because that is very undemocratic, and it is yet another sign of dictatorship. It's only dictators who ban free media from publicizing its information. So that is our stance, and we have said it publicly that we do not agree with the banning of publication of newspapers.
But John Malia, the government is of the opinion that the newspaper misquoted the president, which is against the norm of journalism practice and ethics. What do you say to that?
That is not true. But if you are true, you don't reprimand a newspaper by banning its publication. You can give a warning. You can ask them to rectify. You can ask them to apologize. There are a lot of other measures which are democratic, and in any way they would not deny people's right to access information. The banning is not a solution, much as it declines people's right to information.
The officials of the government are justifying the ban, saying that it will send a strong warning to other publications that publish falsehood, and that this is a clear indication of a newspaper who wants to tarnish the reputation of the president. Not only that, but to undermine and create disaffection among the people by telling lies. Do you think their defense is justified?
It is not. Their defense is purely based on terrorizing the free media in this country and access to information. These trends of banning the entirety of a certain period of time of newspapers is being used to threaten free and independent media from criticizing the government and the president. We have a kind of a president who do not want to be criticized, who only want to be praised. In a circumstance, when you're in a public office, you expect people to criticize you. It's not your personal office, that's a public office. So if people are not happy with what you're doing, they'll either light it or say speak about it. But this regime does not allow people to do that, and that is unfair, unconstitutional, and a sign of a clear indication of dictatorship regime.
Some members of the CCM, the ruling party, are saying that the government has the power to do that, and that is why it enforced this ban on this newspaper for the next 3 months to get its act together to report correctly instead of coming up with what they described as fabrication. Is there a constitutional basis for that as a legal brain?
The powers with the government are draconian because the legal basis of publicizing and accessing information is vested in our constitution. Article 18 states clearly that people have the right to air their opinion, have the right to access information. There are a few enactments which were made recently, the recent one being News Service Act, which give the president and the government totally a power to ban publication of newspapers and such kind of media. Now, the powers, in our opinion, are draconian and are very unconstitutional. So the defense by system members is baseless, and actually it proves that they want to have a dictatorial regime in our country.
John Malia is a leading legal team member of the Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema. He spoke with me from Dodoma. The Ugandan Inspector General of Police, General Kaile Kaihura, says he will not apologize for ordering the arrest of opposition and independent lawmakers in Parliament Wednesday. Security officers were seen live on television beating up parliamentarians following a scuffle in Parliament. They were protesting the suspension of their colleagues who kicked against attempts by the ruling party to amend the constitution to remove age limits that would enable President Yoweri Museveni to seek another term. Matthias Mpuuga was one of the lawmakers who was arrested. I reached him in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, to get a reaction regarding the effort to amend the constitution.
General Kaihura, as we know him, he's always been an outlaw. He is a law unto himself. He's done so many things over the last so many years that do not relate to any law, written or culture or common sense in this land. So that is him, typical. He believes his law. Him and his boss believe they own his country, they can do anything. I am a bit shocked, but not surprised at all, given his history of statements and actions as well. He's the kind, he's actually a sadist. Nothing new about his methods of work. But I would ask him to add that whatever his statements represent, they have nothing to do with what the law says in the case Parliament has issued. The Speaker of Parliament has all the powers under the law to have handled that matter differently. But I am aware General Kaihura, on behalf of his boss, Mr. Museveni, took over Parliament. So, in other words, the military junta took over Parliament. So Parliament is now fused with the military state.
Isn't it part and parcel of a law enshrined in the Ugandan constitution that you cannot arrest a member of Parliament while he's at work in Parliament?
Certainly, that's what I said in my preamble, that the laws of the land are very clear on the immunities. Even if a member did commit a crime of whatever nature, the laws clearly stipulate how a member of parliament can be arraigned or arrested. So it was a clear violation of the law, but Mr. Kaihura thinks he's actually the law, and therefore is able to even brag about his breaking of the law. That's how it is here. But of course, we are aware that there are institutions that can still call Kaihura to order. There have been attempts to secrete them. That is the courts of law. We are going to pursue these individuals in the courts of law, including the Speaker, for allowing herself to be used in the violation of the law to which she's a custodian.
But I understand members of Parliament, including yourself, who were arrested, were unruly, creating chaos and fighting behavior unbecoming of the honorable title that you are giving as legislators in the Ugandan parliament.
I'll tell you something, that even if members of parliament got agitated and raised their voices, the members of parliament did not attack colleagues on the other side of the aisle. Members of parliament, yes, did raise their voices. But this not memory not warrant an attack from the military to pounce on them the way they did in a manner that is akin to, I don't know, to devoid of any manner of respect. The issues that we had in Parliament were clear. And any speaker worth her name or his name would have been able to deal with those matters.
I understand some of your members from the opposition as well as ruling party supporters are against the amendment of the constitution removing age limits that will allow President Museveni to seek yet another term. What is next for you?
Certainly, many of us are opposed to making Museveni a monarch. It's not just about for him to stand again, because when he stands, he steals the victory every election he has stood into. So he's trying to make sure that this time around, there are no roadblocks, whether legal or otherwise, that will deter him from comfortably making himself a president of Uganda. It's been his dream. He has violated and shifted the goalposts since the 1995 constitution was made, including removal of term limits in the constitution, as was done through bribery of members of parliament in 2005. This time around, Mr. Museveni is bribing members of his own party. I am advised with the clause $100,000 per member for them to amend the constitution to make him like president.
Matthias Mpuuga is a Ugandan opposition parliamentarian. He spoke with me from Kampala. The Swaziland Democratic Nurses Union has petitioned the government of what it says is the ongoing shortage of drugs in the Southern African Kingdom. The group says there are shortages of drugs to treat a range of illnesses, including epilepsy, diabetes, ulcers, and for HIV patients. Critics say the shortage of drugs has been ongoing in Swaziland for years. The government, they said, often fails to pay its bills to suppliers. However, the Ministry of Health denied there were drug shortages. Wandile Dludlu, national coordinator for a pro-democracy group known as the Swaziland United Democratic Front, or SUDF, told me his group supports the petition, adding that reports of the shortage of drugs are credible.
There is that challenge in the health sector in Swaziland at the moment, and it is recurrent. It's not just a new one. We have been having this challenge for quite some time. It recurs from time to time. The hospitals, like public hospitals, run out of medication and services like those. And currently we have the challenge. So it is on that basis why we have been supporting and still support the Swaziland Nurses, Democratic Nurses Union, SWATNU, in petitioning His Majesty's government on the issue of lake of drugs.
But Wandile, the Ministry of Health has come out to strongly deny that there were ever any shortages of drugs.
We do not at all, my brother, expect His Majesty's government through the Ministry of Health to acknowledge that they are failing in their duty. They are failing to provide basic services to the nation. It is a fact that because of inherent corruption, government from time to time has had this embarrassing situation where the companies or service providers, as you would call them, fail to provide the services of providing medical and drugs to the government hospitals, because they, in the main, do get paid by government on one hand. But because most of these tenders are given to royalties, companies that belong to people who come from the royal house, it gets impossible for the Ministry of Health to pursue a service provider that is failing to provide drugs.
In June, Swazi Senator Prince Kekela told Parliament that at least five people had died as a result of the shortage of medicines in Swaziland. Meanwhile, at that time, it was reported that the government owes about $80 million to drug companies in May, and the government has yet to pay that amount. And that is why these companies withdrew delivery of medicines until bills were paid. What is the situation on the ground?
Definitely. The problem is exacerbated, my brother, with such challenges wherein, on one hand, the government is, to a greater extent, becoming with cashless or running out of cash, because most of the resources in Swaziland are preserved for what is called royal projects. For instance, currently, money from the state is driven, every cent is driven to the recent hotel convention center that the king has assigned or sanctioned it to be built. There is a multi, like 7 billion worth of a hotel or a convention center in preparation of Swaziland hosting the AU in 2020. On the other hand, Swaziland spent billions in that airport that was recently built because the king wanted it to be. So you do run off a situation where the little resources the government milk out of the ordinary people of Swaziland through heavy taxation gets to be used on royal projects.
But Wandile, the government says that all these are issues that the government is dealing with and trying to address to bring them to normalcy, as well as addressing the concerns of these drug companies so that delivery of medicines will resume. You seem not to agree with that. Why?
There is evidence. There is evidence, there is history to the fact that we are in a humanitarian crisis in Swaziland. It is not just a country with problems. You know, every country has its own challenges and limitations and mishaps here and there. Swaziland has gone beyond past that. You are a country, you are a failed state, where evidence, for instance, the recent report, my brother, that says Swaziland in the world is the most unequal country or society in the world. You have reports indicating that you are doing very badly. You are doing very badly on unemployment. You have 52% unemployment rate in this country. So when it comes to health, the government is slowly but surely losing the capacity to respond.
Wandile Dludlu is the national coordinator for a pro-democracy group known as the Swaziland United Democratic Front, or SUDF. He spoke with me from the capital, Mbabane. The Kenyan main opposition National Super Alliance on Thursday quit negotiations over how to manage next month's presidential election rerun. The party says amendments proposed by the ruling Jubilee Party would create a lame duck commission. This despite the electoral body's stance that more legislation isn't necessary to hold the election and that the proposed changes would place the commission in a precarious situation. But Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta told a campaign rally Friday that the proposed electoral law changes will guarantee transparency by preventing malpractice. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached Fred Omulo, a Kenyan journalist, to find out how prepared the electoral commission is for the vote.
The commission as itself and with its systems, if those systems are supposed to work as expected, can actually hold that election. They can actually deliver the ballots on time. If they let the transmissions go on, as we've seen in some instances, it should be an easy thing. On top of that, this is just a presidential election involving two candidates. It is not like what we had about a month and a half ago, where you had candidates for six different levels. We had almost 10,000 people on the ballots. Now it's only two, and it's across the whole country. So in theory, the IEBC, the Independent Election and Boundaries Commission, should be in a position to actually hold that election.
Fred, what's all this with the government's plan to have new election laws before this upcoming election?
Some strategists within the Jubilee coalition, they looked at the ruling that the Supreme Court gave and the loopholes that actually made them lose. Or should I say, the loopholes that actually made the Supreme Court deny the election and say that it was invalid. So they looked at all those loopholes and weaknesses, and basically they're loosening the laws, or should I say, they're tightening the laws to accommodate those particular loopholes. So, for example, you have an instance where the electronic tally came in, which the opposition said was actually hacked into, showed that President Kenyatta had won. Now, on the basis of that, the Electoral Commission looked at the trend from the manual tallies that they were receiving from across the country and then went ahead and declared him the winner. But now, when the actual manual tally started coming in, some of the results were defective, some of them were wrong, and the Supreme Court looked at that and it said, you arrived at this result through a invalid process. So therefore, the whole exercise is invalid. So what they are saying now is if the electronic tally does not work, we can go for the manual tally, and that will hold. If a decision is made by the Supreme Court in which they find the process flawed, then they should go for a recount rather than a re-election. And other such instances, basically, they are not improving anything. They're just looking at the weaknesses and the loopholes which gave the Supreme Court room to invalidate that election.
Has the gap between Jubilee and NASA narrowed? Are they in agreement as to the next election?
No, they are not in agreement. They put a series of conditions which they wanted met within the IBC, and that included, for example, the resignation of the CEO. And the CEO this week said he's not going anywhere. So those conditions that they put forward are not going to be fulfilled. It's looking at the trend. The other thing is, if NASA refuses to participate in the elections, the repeat elections, the law does not envisage a scenario where you have only one candidate. So we'll have to go to the Supreme Court for an interpretation. So what you believe, they went to Parliament this week, and they proposed that if there's only one candidate, then that candidate should be declared the winner. So it's a little table-turning that's going on here. Everyone is hitting back and forth, and you're not close to any resolution.
Fred Omulo is a Kenyan journalist. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Kisumu. The World Health Organization warns a highly infectious, deadly form of pneumonic plague is spreading rapidly in Madagascar, and quick action is needed to stop it. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Pneumonic plague, which is transmitted from person to person, has been detected in several cities of Madagascar. This worries the World Health Organization, as the disease is highly contagious and quickly causes death without treatment. Plague is endemic to Madagascar, resulting in around 400 cases annually. Most are cases of bubonic plague, which is spread by the fleas of rats and other small rodents. The disease is usually confined to rural areas, but this year it has spread to large urban areas and port cities. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says cases of bubonic as well as the human transmissible pneumonic plague have been found in the capital Antananarivo and the port cities of Mayunga and Twamasina.
So far, 104 cases of plague were reported since first case has been identified that was dating from 23rd of August. So from 23rd of August to 28th September, 104 cases that have been reported, including 20 deaths.
Jazarevich notes the fatality rate is more than 19%. He tells VOA this outbreak is very dangerous and must be brought under control quickly.
The plague epidemic season usually runs from September to April, so we are really at the beginning of the epidemic season of plague, and we already have, so from 23rd of August until yesterday, so it's a little bit, it's like a 5 weeks' time, we had 104 cases, and again, half of those cases were pneumonic plague.
WHO says urgent public health response in terms of surveillance and treatment is required. The health agency has released $250,000 from its emergency fund to get immediate action underway. It plans to appeal for $1.5 million to fully respond to the needs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an inside look at Startup Africa, a nonprofit Delaware-based organization that supports youth in building business skills that foster financial independence, create jobs, and grow financial economies. A discussion on Startup Africa on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, a rebel group in the Democratic Republic of Congo says it plans to overrun the capital, Kinshasa, to remove President Joseph Kabila from power. Led by General William Yakutumba, the rebel group, calling itself the National People's Coalition for the Sovereignty of Congo, says the refusal of the government to hold elections to ensure a smooth transition is a flagrant violation of the agreement signed with the opposition Rassemblement. Freddy Mbuyamu Matungulu is also the leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party, or ACongo, in the local Lingala language, joins me live here in the VOA studios in Washington to discuss the latest development in the DRC. Hello, Freddy.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Good, good, thank you.
Do these rebels have what it takes to overrun the capital, Kinshasa, and remove President Joseph Kabila as they threatened to do?
Well, I think that really remains to be seen. What is important that these rebels are saying, and that is shared by the great majority of the population of the Democratic Republic of Congo, is that the constitution of this country have got to be respected, which means we have got to, as soon as possible, go through these elections and make sure that President Kabila doesn't seek a third term as required by the constitution. I think that's
he said he made
message.
No promises. He said he made no promises when he signed an agreement with the Rassemblement, which called for a transition, for him to lead a transition, and then elections to be held at the end of the year. It's close to the year, no sign of elections.
Absolutely. That's something that everybody in the Congo today regrets a lot, deplores, I would say. Whether he'd made any promises or not, this is what the Constitution calls for, and this has to be done. I'm using the opportunity to express once more my disappointment over the fact that, as you've indicated, under the December 31st agreement of last year, the Congolese were supposed to go to election before the end of 2017. And as you've so rightly pointed out, we're going to the end of the year. And unfortunately, once more, there's not been enough progress in that direction. And that's the reason why a lot of the Congolese, when you listen to them today, many are really thinking that in order for us to have elections under the Constitution or under the agreement or in any form, it's going to be important that there is an administration that is not headed by President Kabila. He has been unable, unfortunately, so far, to really squarely put the country on the road to the election that everybody's waiting for.
You were part of the Rassemblement that negotiated with the agreement. What is left to be done now? Now that it appears the agreement has been violated despite the mediation efforts by the Catholic priests.
I think what's really important is for us to have a roadmap, in other words, an electoral calendar that indicates exactly when the election will take place and what will be the steps running up to that election. And I think that's what everybody is really waiting for. Hopefully, the National Election Committee will come up with that electoral calendar soon. That's what we all are waiting for.
The government says that elections will happen. The voter registration, ongoing voter registration, is proof that it has the political will to organize elections to pave way for the next administration. However, it seemed not to be moving. You are displeased with the process of the voter registration. Why?
I think some of the criticism that we are leveling against what has been accomplished is in the nature of some of the numbers we've seen. Some of the regions of the country seem to be showing increases in the potential number of voters of 67% over what they had actually registered in 2011. So there are some serious issues about the data that the commission has put out. But as you know, once you've completed sort of taking the data in, follows a time of reconciliation of the data to clean up the registry. And it is our hope, my hope personally, that you know, this will provide us with an opportunity to make sure that what comes out of the whole process is an electoral registry that is good for us to have a good election, one that will not be contested once it's been run.
What's next for your party, Congo Nabiso Party? Do you have the national appeal to seriously contend for the presidency of the Democratic Republic of Congo?
No, we definitely have the appeal. We have a good message, a message of change, of improvement in the governance, economic, political governance of the country. As you know, what's really lacking to the Democratic Republic of Congo today is precisely those intangible ingredients, good governance. That is important to make sure that the country is run, the economy is run in such a way that the breaches of the country can really be benefiting the whole nation. We as Congo Nabiso are working hard to put that message across to the people of the Democratic Republic of Congo. We've had the opportunity of being in government as a finance minister and of a record when we were there of managing public goods and public service in the best way possible in the interest of the people. And I think the people of Congo know this. They're just waiting for the time when eventually we'll go to that election. And I'm very confident that when that time comes, we'll have a good record in the voting.
One of your colleagues and at the IMF also running for president in Congo says that your tenure as the finance minister did not bode well for the country, and that some of the measures you put in to stabilize the country were faulty. A PhD holder just like you, what do you say to such criticisms leveled against you?
Well, I don't. There's nobody from the IMF that is running for president other than me. I think there's a fellow countryman who's from World Bank. Yes. Unfortunately, I've not heard exactly what he's been saying about me. But, you know, my record is there for everybody to see. You go to the many IMF reports. You go to all the reports that are out there for anybody to see. We find the country that was in disarray economically when we went in, with inflation running higher than 500%, with growth that had been negative for several years before we came in. And when you look at what we were able to accomplish, inflation brought down to less than 10% when we were there, and a resumption of growth, I think, you know, all these things are there for anybody to see. I have you know, absolute confidence that if you're looking at this objectively, you'll see what we're able to accomplish.
Critics are saying that when you are running for president, lofty promises are made. You have schooled here in the U.S., so you know how to talk, they said. However, when you get into power, it's about grabbing what you can get and forget about the citizens who you promised heaven on earth. What would be different?
But that's exactly the difference between me and some of these people who are coming out who've never run anything in the country. I have been there as finance minister, and contrary to what anybody could be saying along the lines of what you said, my record is very clear. I came in there, I talked about things positively, and I did them. I was not promising. And the reason why, in fact, I resigned from my position as finance minister, something that nobody has ever done before or after me, was because, you know, the kind of reforms that I was putting in place for the country, unfortunately, were not being supported, particularly by the head of state. So I'm not talking theory here. I'm talking about practice, a record. I went in there, did what needed to be done, and everybody saw what I was doing. I'm not promising anything. I'm just, you know, trying to get a new opportunity to go back and continue with the reforms that I started, which unfortunately stalled. And today, when you look at the record of economic governance in the country, you will see that I was right in doing what I did.
So if Congolese repose confidence in you, they elect you as the president, what should they expect under your leadership? in terms of the improving their living conditions, in terms of healthcare, in terms of protection, in terms of maintaining the country's territorial integrity, in terms of protecting life and property, in terms of ensuring that the borders are secure.
But that's exactly what we intend to do, make sure that there's good governance, which will entail improvements in essentially all sectors of life in the country. Security-wise, we have to make sure that there is accountability. If you are holding a region of the country that is being, as we see now, under such a level of instability, there's not going to be any reason for us to keep you there. The same thing, you're managing the economy under our responsibility. If you're responsible for stealing government goods, we will make sure that you are severely punished. I think this is really what's lacking in the country. We have a good culture of governance, good governance. I'm not afraid of saying that I was in the IMF for 22 years, and I know for 22 years all I did was talking about good governance with official from countries, you know, the world over. So for me, it's not just a slogan. I'm talking about things that I know what to do, how to do them, and I have the opportunity to do them, including in the Democratic Republic of Congo as finance minister. Everybody saw that. That's the big difference between me and some of those people that are running around who've never run anything in the country.
Freddy Mbuyamo Matungulu is the leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party, or Our Congo, in the local Lingala language in the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC. He joined me at the Voice of America studios live here in Washington. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Baby, dance, dance, baby, shake, shake, yeah. I'm a hot duck, you know. Hallelujah, Hosanna, girl, you I want to. Get your body, banana, sweet in my heart.
Alahaji, thank you, know I sing a song for you, yeah.
Yeah.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, you cannot pick up a pebble with one finger. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The progress against ISIS in Iraq and Syria is significant, said Special Presidential Envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, Brett McGurk. So far, about 78,000 square kilometers have been liberated from ISIS control, and more than 4 million Iraqis and 2.3 million Syrians no longer live under the terror group. In Iraq, about 2.1 million people have returned to their homes in areas that have been cleared of ISIS. One-third of all these gains have come in the last 8 months and are in large part due to a change in policy under President Donald Trump, who ordered an acceleration of the campaign. A lot of authorities were delegated downward so that we could move faster and move more effectively, and I think that's made a difference on the ground, said Mr. McGurk. In Raqqa, ISIS is now down to about its last three neighborhoods in the north-central part of the city, and it is only a matter of time until the operation in Raqqa is finished. As soon as the military phase is completed, a very significant post-conflict stabilization humanitarian plan will be launched, with about 100 sites identified for immediate demining. In Iraq, the battle in Mosul is over, and the stabilization phase has begun. More than 1 million people were internally displaced from Mosul as a result of the war. We're now focused on returning people to their homes, said Mr. McGurk. The United States has trained well over 100,000 Iraqi security forces, and not a single Iraqi security force unit or Peshmerga unit that has fought ISIS with coalition training has lost a single battle. These forces are now able to conduct simultaneous operations across Iraq. Diplomatically, there is a rapprochement underway between Iraq and Saudi Arabia. One border crossing has already been opened, and there is talk of opening a second. Similarly, with Jordan, a $1 billion a month in commerce route going from Amman to Baghdad has been reopened. With ISIS on its heels and stabilization efforts well underway, the U.S. believes now is a time to press full speed ahead and finish the job.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.